In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Hey, it's time for us to talk movies. And to do that, we welcome in our friend Alan Adams. Pass the Popcorn on Downtown. Happy Monday, Al.
And to you. What's up, lunch meat?
You like that, huh?
I did, yeah, very much. Yeah. I'm probably going to call you that for the foreseeable future.
I like that a lot.
It's really good. It's a really good nickname.
I've been called Olive Loaf before, but that's a long story. There.
Well, yeah, but you went to the doctor, you got some cream, it all cleared up, it's fine.
All better now, yeah. How was your weekend?
Well, it was pretty good. Got to spend a little time with you, among other things.
Yes,
yeah, we did our annual fantasy baseball draft. It's funny, I was talking to our friend Jason Preble, who is making his return to the league after a brief absence. I think this is either my 12th or 13th year.
Is it really?
And it's, oh, gosh. And it's one of those things where it's like I'm still new.
There are some, it's geezer heavy.
Yeah, you know what I mean? And it was just like, but because this was every 5 years cycle through and do the draft down in Southern Maine. This is my third draft in Southern Maine.
Oh my word.
So it's like, wow. I've been doing this. I think 2010 was my first year.
Wow. And Aaron Jackson, the relatively new member, the young guy in the league.
Yep.
And we figured out yesterday the league is older than he is. Wow. Ah, that feels good.
Yeah, real kick in the geriatric teeth, the false teeth.
Right, yeah. Good thing they're not really mine. We're hurt. But that was fun. That was a good time as always. But now it's frustrating to get your team picked, and now got to wait a week and a half for some real baseball.
Yeah. And I'm really looking forward to it. Like I've been watching I've been watching some of the World Baseball Classic just because I love that sort of thing. And I love that so many incredibly talented, performers get to represent their country in a way that baseball just doesn't really do or hasn't in the past.
And it seems to mean a whole lot to them.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the great part is like you just see the joy that comes. And it's easy to forget because, baseball is a business. Like that's the deal. That's these guys play to make money. But when you get to see them, put on their country's colors and represent the place that they came from, like it just hits different and you can tell. And that's something that really, I think, just really enhances the enjoyment for me. That being said, I'm looking forward to getting some MLB games that count on the calendar, particularly since, it's looking like I might actually be able to, occasionally stay up on a weeknight and watch an entire game.
Wow.
Well, I mean, with the pitch clock and all this stuff, it really does seem like they're cutting significant time off these games. And, the difference between, going to bed at 10 o'clock or 11:30, like that's significant for me, So it's like, so I'm pretty stoked about it. Like I'm psyched for the season to get started and I look forward to, watching any number of pitchers on my pitching staff, watching various bits of them fall off over the course of the first few weeks.
You're going to have to get the MLB package, though, so you can watch your new best friend Dalton Varsho in those Blue Jays games.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. Like, I love that Blue Jays team. Like, there are so many great players on that team, and so it'll be really exciting to, it's nice. It's always nice to have a piece of teams that you enjoy. I got a couple of Red Sox players. I don't always, but I got a couple of guys. I got the new guy, Yoshida.
That's a great pickup.
I think so too. But again, like you never know until the games start.
Right.
But I have him and one of the aforementioned pitchers with bits falling off, Corey Kluber, he's the opening day starter.
Yeah. See, I've got James Paxton. He had all his parts have fallen off.
Like the exchange rate's what kills you.
Yes. But it's funny too because I think everybody has those guys they really, really want, and you were very happy to get Varsho yesterday after some spirited bidding.
Well, it was because of the way my team was structured. I very much wanted someone for that second catcher slot because I have the first spot was taken by Alejandro Kirk, who also plays for the Blue Jays, And I held on to Shea Langeliers, who will be the starting catcher for Oakland,
right.
But he's not eligible to play that position yet. And so what I wanted was someone to fit in that second slot that I would also feel comfortable playing elsewhere if that were an option. And the reality is it was Dalton Varsho, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
So I was it's funny. I probably overpaid a little bit, but here's the thing. I would have overpaid more.
Oh, yeah. Well, I did the same thing. Tim Anderson was the cornerstone of my process.
Oh yeah, like, but but that's the thing. It's like, in the end, does it matter if you get someone that you want and you're going to enjoy,
you know?
And like, how many guys like left the, you know, finished the draft with, you know, $5 or $6 left over,
right?
You know, and that's the difference between like a quote unquote overpay. So I mean, what the hell? Like we're doing it to have fun. So
exactly.
So I look forward to my my typical landing between third and seventh place.
Yeah. You've been closer to third than seventh the last several years there. I would like to sniff third from a distance, man. Oh, man. Well, let's talk a little movies. Have you seen anything since last we chatted?
I've seen a couple of things.
Oh, good.
I saw one movie in the movie theater, and I saw another movie at home.
Nice.
At the movies, I went to see Shazam, Fury of the Gods. at home, I watched the Hulu original, The Boston Strangler.
Oh, nice.
Yes, two very different films. Which would you like to discuss first?
Well, let's hear about Shazam. I'm curious.
Okay. First things first, this is a sequel to, Shazam, which came out, I believe, in 2019. And it was, all told, probably my favorite of the first sort of run of DC extended universe movies, simply because it's maybe the one of the bunch that spends at least some time remembering that, this is based on a comic book, you know? And so there's a sense of fun there that I think was somewhat lacking in some of those other films. That feeling of fun does carry over to an extent, in this second film, but, it's you know, diminishing returns, I guess, however you want to describe it. But the truth is, I feel like this movie suffers in large part because the whole DC movie studio situation is so in flux right now, and I don't know that anyone really knew what to do with this movie, because while the first one and this one are sort of, I don't know, like we're sort of adjacent to the grander picture rather than wrapped up as tightly, the truth is, like, that overlap, if James Gunn and company are going to blow it all up over at DC, like, what do you do? Like these movies are just sort of orphaned a little bit,
right?
For better or for worse. The basic gist takes place a couple of years after the events of the first movie. Shazam, played by Zachary Levi, we have Billy Batson, who's played by Asher Adams, but he becomes Shazam when he says the magic word Shazam. He has his whole foster family. They all have powers as well. So we have the Shazam, as they call it, the Shazamily, which hurts me a little bit.
Because it's
the Captain Marvel family. It's always going to be the Captain Marvel family. I understand that there's all kinds of like chicanery with the trademarks and whatnot, particularly now that Marvel is pushing. But he's the big red cheese, and he's Captain Marvel, and that's just how it is. But I digress. Anyway, so they're sort of doing their superhero thing in Philadelphia, where they live. Not doing a great job of it because, again, they're all kids. You know, they have, when their powers come, they become grown ups with powers and whatnot, but they're still kids. And so their attempts at whether it's stopping armed robberies or preventing bridge collapses or what have you, don't necessarily always go super smoothly, to the point where they have been dubbed by the local news media as as a team, they're called the Philadelphia Fiascos, which is pretty hilarious. Anyway, our big bad this time around, we have the Daughters of Atlas, who are, as near as I could tell, made up characters specifically for this movie. They are the daughters of the legendary Titan Atlas, who come to Philadelphia to steal back the powers that were stolen from them by the wizard Shazam, played by a definitely slumming it but still having fun Jimon Hansu. And here's the thing: so the Daughters of Atlas We have Rachel Zegler, who was so wonderful in West Side Story. We have Lucy Liu, and the leader, Dame Helen Mirren.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's so wild to watch these movies and just see the A-listers start rolling through, and you're like, oh, okay. And it's like, you're either A, doing this for your kids or your grandkids, B, for a paycheck, or C, both. those are the options. But here's the thing. I feel like Helen Mirren kind of gets off on these kind of movies. I feel like she really enjoys herself because she, you know, she has a recurring role in the Fast and Furious franchise too. Like this is someone who really enjoys the let's call it the lighter side of movie making.
Yes.
In a way that perhaps others of her generation and pedigree maybe don't. Anyway, so the Daughters of Atlas come back to try to take their powers back, and then, I don't know, chaos ensues. It doesn't. It's one of those things where that's all the story that you need, really, going in, because it's like there's a bunch of superpowered shenanigans, some pretty good jokes, the dynamic, the back and forth dynamic between the young kids and the grown up superhero types is pretty fun, and like it's just a good time at the movies, you know. And I think, while it's not as successful in that respect as the first movie, it still does a much better job than a lot of these superhero films that have started to veer into the realm of maybe taking themselves a little too seriously. And so finding those moments of joy, those moments of levity, I think is super important. And when you have a cast like this one, particularly on the superhero side, because Zachary Levi is great. Like, I mean, I think he has some questionable personal beliefs, but,
yes.
But he's great in this role. Adam Brody is wonderful as Freddie Freeman, who the young Freddie Freeman played by Jack Dylan Glazer, who is one of the better young actors out there in Hollywood right now. And just on down the list, like it's a wonderful collection of talent. Like everyone's clearly having a good time. And yeah, and that's kind of it. And it did have the mid-credit and post-credit stinger scenes and all that. But there's something to be said for watching one of these movies and realizing, you know, this might be it, and that's okay. You know, like it's not like you're like, you know, these post-credit scenes do indicate something coming down the road, but like they're separate enough from what we've just seen that it doesn't really matter if this is the end of the line. It would kind of be a shame because I like these characters and I like the way they're being portrayed, but I also think the hard reboot that James Gunn and company are planning is probably the way to go. It's just they've kind of backed themselves into a grungy dark corner, and they really need to dig their way out. And hopefully, what that means is we'll get more movies that are at least tonally similar to this one.
See a couple of friends of our show were in it too, in small parts. PJ Byrne has a role, and Michael Gray has a brief cameo. Michael Gray played Billy Batson in the 70s TV show.
And he's wearing the shirt.
Oh, he is?
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, the red shirt with the red ringer. Yeah, like it's, yeah, it's, yeah, you see it and it's like, oh, yeah, it's that guy.
I love it.
But yeah, your man PJ Byrne is, it's not a spoiler really, because it happens in the first few minutes of the movie, but he is serving as a confidant of sorts to our Shazam. But here's the thing, he's a pediatrician. But it's the only doctor Billy Batson knows, so that's who he goes to talk to. Yeah, it's like the performances are good, like everybody's having fun, and ultimately with a movie like this, like that's really all you want.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, tell us about the Boston Strangler. I mean, Chris Cooper's in it, so I'm in because he makes everything better.
Man, he crushes it too. Yeah, they're all pretty great. It's. I'm not going to sit here and relitigate the whole situation with the Boston Strangler for the quick, you know, thumbnail sketch. Back in the early 60s, there were a series of murders in the Boston area. And no one seemed to know exactly what was going on, including, most damningly, the Boston Police Department. Mm. Not only did they not know, they didn't seem super interested in working too hard to figure out what was going on. But this movie, we don't really see a lot of the Strangler.
Hmm.
It's very much, and you know, near and dear to my heart, it's very much a newspaper movie.
Ah.
It revolves around Loretta McLaughlin, who was the reporter at the Boston Record American, who first started breaking this story, making the connections, putting the pieces together, played by the wonderful Keira Knightley.
Oh, nice.
And McLaughlin's eventual partner on these stories, Gene Cole, played by Carrie Coon. So it's like, wow, you've got a really nice, you know, pairing there at the center of your film. But yeah, we basically just watch as McLaughlin, you know, slowly starts, you know, pushing to work this story more and more. Like, she, you know, she's sick of being on the lifestyle desk and, you know, writing, you know, gossip columns or, you know, reviewing toasters. Like, she doesn't want to do that anymore. She wants to do real journalism. And when she starts putting these pieces together on her own, like, this is something that she's doing sort of outside the purview of her regular work, you know, she starts connecting the dots. And when she connects enough, she finally convinces her boss, Jack McClain, Chris Cooper, to let her have a swing at it. And then we're deep diving. Like, we're going in and we start learning about, you know, your of course Albert DeSalvo, played by David Desmalchian, who is great.
Do I know him from something?
Yes, you do. Okay. I can't remember anything else that he's in off the top of my head, but like, he's one of those people, like, you see him and it's like, "Oh, that guy. Yeah. I've seen him in a million things."
Okay.
George Nasser and Daniel Marsh and all these other sort of peripheral figures who may or may not have contributed to some or all of these murders. And it's just and we just watch, you know, investigative reporting, like old school, like 1960s, like, you know, knocking on doors and like trying to get police officers to talk and knowing that most of them won't, you know, the blue wall of silence and all that stuff. And, you know, as she struggles to put the pieces together, you know, she starts catching flack from all sides because, you know, not only is she a newspaper reporter who's questioning the almighty Boston PD, she's a woman.
Oh.
And, you know, she and her partner are both women. And that is not something that necessarily went over super well in the early 1960s. Well, really anywhere in America, but certainly not in the city of Boston.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, and it's really very much a movie about a reporter. Like, it's about assembling the story and, you know, following leads and hitting dead ends and red herrings and all that stuff. And watching as this, as the story sort of unfolds. And being reminded that, in my head, I was like, "Oh yeah, no, Albert DeSalvo, he's the Boston Strangler." And then it's like, "Oh wait, no, he's not." Like, I mean, he was involved in linked to some of the situation, but a number of the cases remain unsolved,
including one right here in Bangor.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and it's like, and talking about, like, you know, like stuff happening in Michigan and in New York State and all this stuff, and just seeing all the, you know, like, just how many things fell through the cracks for this to happen. And it's one of those, and you know, you just sort of come to terms with the idea that, you know, like, someone got away with this. Yeah. Like, it seems unlikely that anyone is going to be, held accountable for this. Despite the incredible efforts being made by people, in the media, which made for a really compelling viewing. The performances, of course, are phenomenal, which certainly helps. I love a good period piece, particularly, mid-20th century. Like, I love that stuff. They did a really good job of crafting that world. Doesn't hurt that it's Boston, which still kind of looks like it's in the middle of the 20th century in a lot of places. But yeah, really well made. It's available on Hulu, currently streaming. And yeah, if you have any interest in this story at all, or just want, like, if you like, if you're interested in that sort of history, if you're a fan of a newspaper movie, or just, you know, quality acting, it really hits all the high notes. So it's a really good. I was going to say it's a really good time. That's not exactly true, but it's an excellent movie.
Nice. I need to check that out. Sounds good.
For sure.
All right. Thanks, Al.
Hey, my pleasure.